Have you ever applied a skincare product to your body and wondered what kind of crazy chemicals are in it, and then read the ingredient list and realized you can't even pronounce half the ingredients? Your skin is the largest organ of your body, and what you put on it becomes part of you. In fact, if your skincare has chemicals you wouldn't eat, you probably ought not rub it all over your body. This is why in our house we use Tallow Skin Solutions Body Butter. It is made with all natural ingredients that are safe enough to eat and offer your skin the nutrients it can thrive on. The tallow is sourced from a family farm in Georgia, which practices sustainable regenerative agriculture. The body butter also has organic coconut oil, organic cocoa butter, and organic essential oils. The texture is silky and luxurious as it is whipped to the perfect consistency. Enjoy one of the five different scents. My personal favorite is creamsicle, which blends vanilla and orange and smells delicious. If you've never used a natural product like this, you are in for a treat. Go to tallowskinsolutions.com and enter code MINDFUL for 20% off. That's tallowskinsolutions.com and use code MINDFUL for 20% off your next order.
A lot of smart people don't feel so smart when it comes to their money. So Morgan Stanley made a podcast to help. Listen to What Should I Do With My Money? To hear real people ask real questions about money and get helpful answers from experienced financial advisors.
Hello and welcome to the Mindful Movement Podcast. I'm your host, Les Raymond. Thanks for tuning in for another episode. I had the gratifying opportunity today to extend my thank you to Erwan LaCour. Erwan has had a big impact on my movement journey. Erwan is the founder of MoveNat and the author of The Practice of Natural Movement. Through his work, I have been inspired over the years to look at the outdoor space that I have access to through a different lens. I look at my outside now as really is an extension of my living space, and I've incorporated the outdoors with my fitness and my movement practice. The benefits I've gotten from this have equated to just a giant upgrade in my sense of well-being. There is something about connecting with nature and really integrating it into the way that you spend your time that has a dramatic impact in your overall sense of well-being. I hope that through this conversation, the listeners could find some inspiration to see what outdoor space you have access to can offer you as you look for ways to integrate that environment more into your way of being. I hope you enjoy the episode. All right, I have Erwan LaCour from MoveNat, the author of The Practice of Natural Movement, and a national record holder with breath holds. Erwan, thanks for joining us today on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
It's my pleasure.
I got to tell you, first of all, I have to just say thank you. So you've had a big impact on me. You don't know this. We've never met. But many years ago, when I was deepening my movement practice, somehow I stumbled upon YouTube videos of a man running through the woods barefoot doing all kinds of playful activity. That looked completely at one with nature, completely in tune with it, resonating with the earth itself. And I was inspired. Since then, that inspired me to go out in the woods in my backyard, to lose the shoes, lose the socks, connect a little deeper. And it's been a real beautiful journey, what has unfolded for me in my own movement practice. So I want to say thank you for that inspiration. I think there's a lot of people out there that you've never met that you have offered that for. So I really appreciate it and will forever be grateful. It's altered my course of my movement practice.
I too appreciate your kind words. Thank you for sharing your feedback.
I was actually really sure. I am a gym owner in Maryland, and one of the trainers I hired years ago who's been on this podcast, her name is Laura. She connected with me looking for a place of employment. And when I saw on her resume that she had gone through MoveNat, I remember being really excited because I thought through her, I could learn a little bit more of your techniques because I have not gone through your certifications.
But I would love to hear a little bit about more what MoveNat is, why you created that, how you got into that. And I know you've been doing a lot in the breathwork world, and you're, as I said, a record holder for breath holds, which I find fascinating. And I'm always open to learning more about breath and its relationship with our physiology. So I think you probably have a lot to offer me and my audience. So maybe we could start off by just having some context of how you got into movement in general, and what brought you to where you are today.
Well, all right, so that is a lot to cover.
I know we only have 50 minutes or so, you can compress that.
Okay, so let's start with MoveNat. You were talking about that one video that you watched many years ago. Indeed, I was 2008, 2009 maybe. And I was going through nature doing all kind of movements, but those movements that you would do in nature, which are to run, to crawl, to jump and climb and balance and to overcome many forms of obstacles in nature. And I call that MoveNat, which is the name of the method that I've created. And I've also coined the term natural movement for that idea that we human beings, all of us, regardless of what we look like and where we come from, are meant to move a way that is universal. We have like a foundation that we all share of movement that is natural movement. So natural movement in that sense, it's not going to be yoga or tai chi, which stem from a specific culture, like from India or China or wherever that is. Natural movement is what you see all young children do, regardless of, again, their background, their ethnicity, in Africa, in Europe, in the Americas, in Asia, anywhere you go. You'll see young children go through the same process of developing the same movement abilities, which are, they're going to be crawling, rolling, going to start to stand and then walk. Ultimately, they'll balance and run and jump and land and climb and lift things and toss things. And so why is it that it looks like it's a program, a universal program, a physical program that is instinctive? It's really universal and it's really instinctive. Every single parent all over the world is going to try to tell their kids, please don't do that. Don't vault over the couch. Don't crawl under the table. Don't jump off the chair and so on. And why? Because all these kids, boys and girls, are expressing the same human movement patterns. And those human patterns, the totality of it, I've called natural movement. Now, all of us have done it. All of us can do it, but to what extent do we still do it? And with what level of efficiency or effectiveness can we still do it as adults? That is a different question. Now, when we can dismiss the necessity of those movements, we are basically, most of us culturally, socially, are raised and trained to dismiss the necessity of those movements. But why, as an adult, why would you crawl on all four? Why would you hang and climb anything? Why would you jump and land, except if it's part maybe of a very specific, very regimented fitness program? But otherwise, you think that you will look weird if you do these things. That you're not supposed to do those things. It's for kids or it's for animals or something. It's not you. It's not supposed to be part of your expression as a person. Well, that's too bad, because that's actually natural movement. It's a birthright. We all should do it. It keeps us really healthy. It makes us feel good. It's a little, if you were to put any wild animal in an enclosure and then tell them, you know what, you can only walk in circles or swim in circles. How depressing. Yeah. Well, that's what's happening to most adults today, because we stand, We walk a few steps to the next seat, and then we sit, and then we sit for hours, and then we stand up, go to the next seat, repeat, and we do that every day. So where's the movement expression? Where's the natural movement that we once knew and experienced and had when we were kids? So MoveNat is a method that teaches you, first, that authorizes you, that inspires you, that enables you to express all those movement abilities again as a form of fitness. You do this, you move that way naturally, you'll become fit naturally as well. And not only we do that, but we teach people techniques so that they can do all these movements in a way that is safe and effective, of course, but also efficient. It's a little like a martial art that would extend to many other practical skills than just being able to defend yourself. You don't go in a bar to learn, or in the street to learn, you know, how to fight. You don't start fights out there with random people. No, you go to a special place with a teacher or sensei, a master, whatever you want to call that person. And they're not going to send you back to the gym so that you're fit enough so that you can learn techniques. Straight away, they will teach you, okay, these are the basic techniques that you need to learn. Why? Well, because efficiency is paramount. It's the most important. So the same applies to the way you run, the way you jump and land, the way you hang and climb, the way you balance, the way you move on all fours, the way you breathe, all of that. This is what the MoveNat method teaches people. And ultimately, you are going to acquire what we call real world physical capability. You become capable to operate your body in the real world if needed. And by the way, typically, you know, when you need to move furniture or when there is a real issue, like a threat maybe, and you need to respond physically, typically you're not going to do yoga, you're not going to do tai chi, you're not going to do ping pong, you're not going to do crunches or sit-ups, or no, what are you going to do? Run for your life, lift and carry somebody to save theirs, climb and jump over the obstacle so that you can get out of a tight spot or reach somebody who needs your help, etc. That you are in the military, that you are law enforcement, that you are especially a firefighter. Look at the movements they need. Look at the physical capabilities they need. It's absolutely natural movement. They need to run and jump and land and climb and balance and lift and carry heavy things and so forth.
It's funny so you what say
better,
that.
What a better way to do fitness, to train your body, than to learn to be physically helpful to yourself and others by learning those techniques and by becoming specifically fit in the process. That's the MoveNat mindset.
It's funny you say that. There was locally, the fire department has a test in my county, and I'm sure many have them, where it's a fairly physical demanding test. And I went through it because some of the local gym owners in my area got certified to help people that were trying to pass the test, that were trying to become firefighters. So we were able to like put together programs for them in the gym to better prepare for it. But the test is, I mean, there's a section where you're crawling through a tunnel. It's basically trying to represent carrying your equipment up a high rise and saving someone's life. And there's a part where you're crawling through a tunnel that's about 3 by 3 feet wide on all fours with a 70 pound weight on your back in the dark, and feeling your way through. And yeah, you're dragging a 180 pound body. You're putting up ladders. You're opening up doors with like a sledgehammer, like all this things that we wouldn't really associate with like exercises we do in a gym. But I went into it with no specific training for the test, but at this point, years of flopping around on the floor, you know, lots of crawling, lots of loaded crawls, lots of weird carries, lots of outdoor work, barefoot. And I don't think it's coincidence. It served me really well. First try, passed the test with no, I was kind of impressed by how they put it together. I mean, it was hard and it seemed to be really well thought out, but it was anything but orderly and structured. It was, you know, what's real when something actually happens. And yeah, these like innate patterns that are kind of hardwired into our DNA that we express in the first year of our life when we're learning to respond to our environment, the gravity, the ground, the three planes that we live in, and how to, you know, with our anatomical design, like respond to those environmental parameters to learn how to move our body and navigate through space. All those things are like built into everything that was meaningful. And it's really nice to kind of draw those connections. I'm also always amazed when you look, when you relearn some of the more fundamental movement patterns that we develop in, you know, very early childhood, few months old, as an adult, as we reconnect with them and you realize how hard they could be, like how challenging.
Yes.
Like these little transitions from lifting your head up to, you know, progressing to higher positions where you have to manage force going through your body and in a way that is very challenging. And kids do it without anybody telling them how to do it. So they do this very challenging thing where I see adults every day in the gym shaking through these.
They train all day.
Yeah, they train all day. But none of the adults in the room are saying, now draw your shoulders down. Or like, there's no direction. And they're still doing something that's hard.
Yes. Because it's a program. It's a universal program. Yeah. It's in us. And not that they are not learning on the way, obviously. A 6 years old is more able of movement than a 4 years old. And then the 2 years old, and then will be 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, imagining that not only they would be left free to keep exercising their body and exploring their abilities that way, but even supported and or encouraged to do it. Then imagine what they become 12, 14, 16, forces of nature, very athletic, naturally capable of jumping, landing, climbing, again, doing all these real world movements. And why would you not call that fitness? That is the real meaning of fitness, but it's beyond how much can you bench or what your glutes and your abs look like. That is not the concern, even though if your overall lifestyle is healthy and you do train that way, you bet that you're going to have a very good athletic looking body.
Yeah, the form definitely will follow the function.
Yes, yes. Sure. But most important, the function. So if you have a body that you make to look a certain way that is deemed to be looking fit by modern standards, and you put them to the test, that kind of test you talked about, the kind of test that we at MoveNat put people through, very simple movement sometimes, just squat, get down to the ground and back up without using your hands or your knees. Can you do that? And most people realize that they just can't. It's not even anything complicated. It does not require a lot of strength. And yet there are so many limitations. I've seen those limitations, including in elite like MMA fighters or special operators. I've seen them sometimes struggle with some of the most natural and simplest natural movements.
Right.
Why? Because it is really not part of people's lives no more. Okay. Those movements are totally taken out of our day-to-day behavior. So after a few years of that kind of neglect, we lose it, right? We have chairs and couches to sit on. So at what point do we need to get up and down to the ground or to squat for an extended amount of time or to hang and climb anything or to jump off anything or over or around anything? We don't need it at home. We don't need it at school. We don't need it in the street. We don't need it at work. We don't need it at the gym. Right. So in some professions, there are some professions, some people have to climb a certain way or some kind of up, you know, whatever, poles or trees. And in some other jobs, they need to hike or they need to lift things. Typically, it's very specialized. Few people like firefighters have jobs that require from them that they have a baseline of capability in that full scope of abilities that are again physical capabilities for the real world.
Do you still, when I saw those videos of you, I see you now, I see a changing in the color of the hair on your beard, as with mine. You know what I mean? We are getting, I'd like to say wiser, we're getting older. Do you still incorporate all those, that practice? Do you integrate that into your life on a day-to-day basis still?
Not on a day-to-day basis necessarily, but frequently enough. And most importantly, I have my own ways to practice, and I have my own way because I'm just like anybody else. I'm busy, you know. I have work to do. I have children to take care of, et cetera, et cetera. So I know how to manage my body and to test my abilities in simple ways to know how capable I am and if I need to train a certain way or specific things to just maintain the baseline that I know is, you know, what I'm capable of, that I've always been capable of. So even being 51, all the things that I could do at 41, 31, I still can't do them. That it is running, swimming, lifting, climbing, jumping, all of it.
That's great.
And that's what matters rather than, oh, okay, do you practice every day or do you? But what is for sure is that it's not like a sport where you'd be like, oh, okay, I cannot perform at the highest level like when I was 20 or 30, so I quit. No. It's a mindset. The mindset is that which of I am a human being, I am physically capable, and I must keep myself physically capable for myself and others, starting with my family, my children. If anything happens, physically I can respond. As an example, as a father, I can show them that even at 51, I can run, I can climb, I can jump, I can land, I can hold my breath, I can swim, I can do all these things. My children know that Papa, because I'm originally French, so we say Papa instead of Daddy, is not walking clumsily when he takes off his shoes or unable to run more than 50 yards because he's out of breath or he could not hang from anything he would land or right away, or he could not carry both of them on his shoulders and so forth. So it's a mindset, and you need to also think of not only maintaining those abilities for yourself the longest you can, but also to do so because that's an example you set for the future generations, starting with your own children.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, it's on one hand, it's important for us to work hard on ourselves to set that example. And almost like the flip side of the coin, I feel, is that kids in some ways are our best teachers. Like if there's a fountain of youth, it's look at what little kids do what they do. So yeah, they get on the ground, they move, they run, they climb, they play, they fall. They also are like very willing to laugh and dance and cry, and they generally don't care what other people think about them. And there's so many lessons to learn from that in all of those aspects. And, you know, the movement's just one part. And then, you know, if we're open-minded, we see that seeing them will nourish us And then as we practice, we teach them that it doesn't go away. It's a mindset. It's a lifestyle. It's a way of living. And they could see that, oh, you know, it's a sustainable thing. You don't have to hang it up when you get a job and there's a chair for you to sit in and kind of give up on being young. You mentioned you can hold your breath. And boy, that's an understatement, Erwan. The national record holder, am I saying this right? 6 minutes and 46 seconds you held your breath?
Okay, so let's set this straight. Actually I can hold my breath for 8 minutes. There are two world federations for what's called free diving. And holding your breath the longest possible in a static fashion without moving is one of the disciplines. There are also holding your breath while you are swimming underwater with no fins, with fins, with a monofin, and you can do the same also going down at depth. So those are incredibly hard feats. And
they sound it.
So one of them is just holding your breath, doing nothing else, but so, which is pretty easy, you know, you just hold your breath, you wait.
Yeah, so, wait for 8 minutes. Yeah, easy.
All right. Okay. So I hold one of the two national records, which is 6:46. And in January, I'll attempt to break it. But my personal record is at 8 minutes, 2 seconds. And that was last January. So I believe that I'm beyond that at this point.
That is
because just... I've done 7 minutes twice, but here at the altitude where I live, which is 7,600 feet or something like that. Okay. So 2,300 feet elevation. So that would equal technically on the paper to something beyond 8 minutes, more like between 8:30 and 9 minutes.
So you really notice a difference as you change elevation?
Yeah, obviously, yes. The the atmospheric pressure is less. So that means that the concentration of oxygen is less also. So it's not that there's less oxygen in percentage, but there's less oxygen in concentration per volume of air. It's a little
I definitely looking to learn a bit more about that. So I've been practicing breath work for a while, bunch of different styles, many through like yoga practices, different pranayama, played with Wim Hof a little bit, Buteyko breathing, and I love it all. I find, you know, there's like a style for every mood I'm in to deploy, you know, and enjoy. And recently, I guess you came back in my field awareness. It was on my feed. I don't know if it was on one of the social media platforms. And I was like, oh man, I haven't seen anything from Ron in a while. And it was about breathing. And you had like a little mini course to do it. And it was interesting because I've done a lot of breath holds, nothing in the ballpark. I think I've flirted with 3 minutes before, but nothing crazy like the numbers you're putting out there. But I do find that I could pretty much in any given moment get to 1 or 2 minutes and get some really neat benefits from it, I find. But what I've noticed is I don't know if it's because what's been taught to me or I've really just gravitated towards these breath holds where they're exhale holds essentially. So regardless of the style that's leading up to the hold, I generally feel really comfortable holding my breath either at the end of the exhale or, you know, starting with a really long exhale. And your first message that I received was really a different style where the breath hold is after the inhale, which, you know, innately seems right. Like that's if you said, go hold your breath to someone and didn't tell them anything, they'd probably inhale and then hold their breath. But yeah. I've learned all these practices that are like the other way around, and I've got a lot of benefits and joy out of them. I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about maybe that difference or why that's what's on that initial hello of your mini course. Like, What is it about that style breath that you find offers something that the other styles seem to miss out?
Well, so first off, I too hold my breath after exhales, either passive exhales, a natural exhale, or forced exhales. And there are benefits to that. And it is also part of what I call breath hold work, which is my method. So breath hold work is both breath work and breath hold work. So it's not only the practice of breath, which is diverse ways to change your ventilation. So let's call breathing, because there's a lot to understand. In order to answer your question, I need to reframe things a bit.
Sure.
When we breathe, that's ventilation. We inhale, we exhale. That's ventilation. It's the biomechanical part of our breathing. And there's the breathing within, which is called cellular respiration. It's what's happening at a biochemical level within our cells, that gas exchange, that primarily the goal of that is to keeps us oxygenated, because without oxygen, we know that our cells are going to die. And when cells die, it's no good, because we die too, like the whole thing is dying. So when you are going to change the way you breathe, the ventilation, you're going to play with it, you're going to manipulate it, you're going to modify it. It's not the way you would typically breathe reflexively when you do something else. You watch a show, you work, you do anything else. You don't think about breathing. It's taken care of. It's taken care of by your autonomic nervous system. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait, I'm breathing and I could change that. Wow. It's powerful. Like I can consciously decide that I'm going to modify my breathing instead of let it be. And then you have all these different exercises, these different methods. And if you think about it, there are almost countless ways you could modify your breathing just because you can. Now, what few people understand is what is exactly going to happen at a cellular level of breathing, the cellular respiration, whenever you change the way you normally breathe, because there will always be an impact internally on your cellular respiration and on your nervous system. What is that impact? Well, it depends on the way you manipulate your breathing. And this is not always taught by the people who tell you how to do the exercises. They just tell you, do the exercise that way. They may not tell you, okay, this is what's going to happen to your cellular respiration if you do that, and this is what's going to happen to your nervous system if you do that. The problem with that is that, do you actually need that exercise in the moment? Who needs what and for what benefit? Because you could be in a place where you're not physiologically ready or neurologically ready for what that specific breathing drill is going to do to you. But you've not been told that because you're part of a group, or because it's just, okay, just do that and do the exercise and that's it. Don't ask questions. So I guess the first point I want to say is be careful the way you modify your breathing, because it does have an impact, and that impact is not always beneficial. It's not always like, oh, I see rainbows and I feel relaxed. And no, it's not always that. It's not always that, because it depends on, again, on what is your current state physiologically and neurologically, and what do you need? And then there is the practice of holding your breath. Now you talk about ventilation. Well, there's no more ventilation at all. You're not even really manipulating your ventilation, or you are ultimately manipulating it, because you're just pausing it. You don't breathe at all. You don't inhale, you don't exhale no more. Now, what is this going to happen? to trigger and what is going to happen within at a physiological level and a neurological level. And why would you do that? And how do you do that? Well, again, so there are different ways to do that as well. Why is it that I do it primarily after a large inhale? Well, because there are more benefits overall. There are more benefits to doing it that way than doing it after an exhale.
Can you speak to some of those benefits?
Absolutely. One of them being what is called CO2 tolerance, which is the ability to tolerate elevated levels of CO2 in your system, starting with your bloodstream and your lungs. So when you pause all ventilation, your cells keep being alive and your cells keep using oxygen. And you keep, as a result, generate what's called CO2, carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide has nowhere to go. Normally it would be exhaled, but now it's retained. So it accumulates in your bloodstream. It changes the biochemistry of your bloodstream. An increase of CO2 means a decrease in pH. Your blood becomes more acidic. Your respiratory centers, which are in your what's called the brainstem in the medulla oblongata, you have chemoreceptors. They are receptors, chemical receptors, central chemoreceptors. They sense that there is that elevation in the acidity of the blood, and that's typically a problem. Means, well, you need to ventilate more, you need to breathe more to exhale that, but because you don't, it keeps going up. And so it means that it's going to alert you, it's going to agitate you, it's going to stress you big time. So you see, when you exhale, you will want to breathe much earlier. But when you take a large breath, you have a lot of air in your tank, you have a lot of oxygen. Therefore, you do not have any concern to have about the oxygenation of your body, or including the oxygenation of your brain. That is not the problem you're dealing with. When you want to breathe, that's not because you start lacking oxygen. It's because the buildup of CO2 gets so high that you start to stress because of that. So the ability to handle that stress is very important. And obviously, when you start your breath hold after exhaling, you will not have a lot of time to generate that CO2 buildup, and therefore to have to learn to calm your mind through that. So that's number one. It's your ability to, what I call, to downregulate at a neurological level. And number two, when you take a large breath, and then you're going to hold it. So you're holding a level of pressure inside your lungs called intrathoracic pressure or intrapulmonary pressure. That's unusual, and that's higher than what you're used to. That too is a stress. So now you're dealing with two internal stressors. And your ability to deal with an internal stressor is basically your own ability to deal with stress. So you're learning to deal with stress, how to respond to stress. But at a physical and physiological level, the fact that your lungs are full and held for minutes at a time or a certain amount of time, and they're stretched, well, this is going to improve their elasticity. This is going to improve their diffusion power, means how fast, how much oxygen, and how fast transitions from the inside of your lungs into your bloodstream. Is going to increase what's called alveolar area, which is the inner surface of your lungs that's exposed to air, the air that you breathe. And there's a correlation between the size of your lungs and that alveolar area and longevity. So it's good for longevity. It's good for oxygenation. Basically, when you train this way, by the way, you were asking about the difference between holding your breath on full lungs and holding your breath after an exhale. Well, when you hold your breath after an exhale, you keep your lungs small. So you don't grow a pair of lungs. You don't. You want to grow a pair of lungs. Actually, we have three lobes. So, I mean, it's a pair of lungs. We have two lungs. We have three lobes. They have a certain size. And it is known by the whole medical field that elderly people who have a greater, what's called vital capacity, basically they have bigger lungs, enjoy better quality of life, greater health, greater longevity. Why? Because if your lungs are bigger, and typically when they're bigger means they're bigger because they exercise, they are being exercised more through exercise, through like running or anything like that, but also breath holding. When you breathe normally, your regular breathing, it's easier, more economical for you to breathe. So you make less effort. You provide less effort just doing regular breathing. It's more economical.
So it's just you are like you're flexing a muscle, you're making it stronger, and then it makes everything else easier for it. Like the everyday demands of it become easier.
Yes, exactly.
When I've been practicing a little bit, and it's interesting because when I do big inhales, they're usually not hold. So I don't linger long enough to notice some of the nuance. And now that I've been playing around with it, I'm noticing like I have more awareness of where the restrictions in my ribs are, because I'm creating that, I guess, intrapulmonary pressure. There's a pressure on my ribs. Yes. And as you sit there for, a minute or so, you have time to like notice things like how they feel. And I'm discovering areas of like stuckness where there's not as much movement. It doesn't feel even. Whereas if I wasn't holding, I don't think I would ever notice that. So it's giving me like little lessons of like, hey, what are you neglecting over here? Are you lacking some mobility, some range of motion in your ribs? And I assume that would improve just through practice from creating that.
Yes.
From the inside.
Yes, that absolutely. And also, so it will improve your tolerance to the, it's a mild form of stress. The great thing about this kind of practice, it's obviously one of those mindful practices where stresses are internal, they're not external. It's not cold is external, heat is external. It's just you, and you, by the way, you can stop the stress anytime you want. You can breathe anytime you want. It's easy.
Right.
Okay, so you may have a conscious decision. It's a mindful decision. I'm going to hold my breath for as long as I can, for instance, or for a whole minute. So it's a conscious decision, right? It's deliberate. And then you're doing it, and then you feel stressed. Then you're like, oh, wait, no, I don't want to do that anymore. So there are levels here of, psychological considerations. Do you have commitment? Do you have self-discipline? Do you have courage? Do you have self-compassion because you're suffering? But do you have indeed resiliency and an ability to commit? Then because of biochemical changes, and it's not just biochemical, okay? It's also at a hormonal level. It's all the whole neurophysiological processes that are taking place. It's basically your autonomic nervous system, which is another part of your consciousness, another part of your brain. It's not another person. It's just the same person that says, knock, knock, listen up, big guy. I know you think you are on top of the world and you're the king or the queen. You said you were going to hold your breath no matter what, but if you keep doing that, it's dangerous, whatever. It's perceived as a threat. And it's going to do all it can to defeat you and to resume ventilation. So basically you have a conflict of of power within you. The one mindful mind that says, I choose, so I decide so. And then the autonomic nervous system that says, excuse me, but no, you're not going to be in charge no more. I'm in charge. I'm in charge of survival. So I'm going to agitate you. You're going to feel horrible. You're going to feel emotionally unstable, negative. Your thoughts are going to start being negative too. You're going to start fighting yourself with your own decision. You'll lose all peace, all clarity, all centeredness, and you'll breathe again. So how do you meditate through this? And that's the question. How do you know thyself better? Because everybody knows that it's not going to be pleasant. And if you keep doing it, it's going to be an ordeal. And you will even obviously question the necessity to do this. Like, why even do this in the first place? That's ridiculous. There's got to be a way to meditate that actually makes me peaceful and centered. When you think about it, conventional meditation implies that you avoid all and any kind of stress. Two, you will use slow breathing to help quiet your mind. Now, how can you call a breath work and meditation, holding your breath and meditate at the same time? When one, it instantly creates, triggers an internal stress, a physiological stress that obviously becomes a neurological stress, a psychological stress, an emotional stress. So how do you respond to that stress that you and nobody else creates? You can't say, hey, you're doing this to me. No, you're doing this to yourself. Number one, you made the decision, so now deal with it. And two, well, can I use breathing and like the regulation of my breathing to de-agitate, to calm my mind, to center my mind, to reclaim stillness? Well, no, you can't because you're holding your breath. Oh, all right. So how do I center my mind, tranquilize my mind, and establish peace and stillness when I cannot use breath and when I'm dealing with the stress which is caused by not breathing? And that is precisely why it's a very powerful form of meditation.
So do you feel everybody has to kind of create their own little internal hacks or thought processes to navigate through that very question where you can't rely on your breath? Like, nobody could really tell you how to do that. Or, I mean, maybe, I guess you can get ideas, but do you feel like that's something that just really has to be discovered through practice and self-exploration?
Why would you assume that it cannot be learned and taught? That's exactly what I
That's what teach. You do, yeah.
That's exactly what I teach. Because who has not tried and played around with this? Clearly you say, right. Yeah. And all my students have as well, including some who are and were experienced meditators, people who've done a lot of meditation, but that meditation does not and did not apply to breath holding. Why?
It's an interesting concept. You don't have the breath, the tool that you want to rely on to get through that, like the managing of the stress involved, or, you know, even if it's just the conflicts that come up in your mind, the narrative that's emerging, that's telling you that there's a fight there to deal with, you know, the stress thing. So I remember hearing a study talking about stress and the hormetic, the positive response to stress, and how there's a line that you cross. Like, if it's a voluntary stress, it's a very positive hormetic stress response you get compared to involuntary. I think it was like a rat study where they force them to exercise, or they give them the choice to exercise. They each do the same exercise. So they have the same nominal amount of stress, but it's perceived differently because one's jumping on the machine and one's being put there, essentially. You know, like you, when you know it's coming and you're choosing it, there's a much better, like more positive physiological response you get from that stress, as opposed to just, you know, getting the negative part without the positive rebound or something. Do you think there's something to be said for that? Like you're creating this mild stress and then you're managing it and you're kind of flexing the muscle. You're strengthening your ability to just manage a stress, and and you get this positive physiological benefit because you put yourself in there. It wasn't like you were thrown into a fiery pit. You kind of prepared and cleared your mind and walked over the coals or whatever. Like you, there's a psychological component to it that really alters the type of benefit, the type of response that comes from the practice. Do you think there's something to be said about that? Because that sounds stressful. I mean, when you talk about a breath hold, you're right. Like you're fighting innate forces where your autonomic nervous system wants you to do something very different than what you're doing.
Yeah. And the point is to align all your different selves, basically. It's almost like there are several of us inside. There are different executive functions of the brain. So you have that conscious mind that makes the decision of, let's say, holding your breath for a certain amount of time, for the longest time possible. And then you have the autonomic nervous system. And then you have a limbic brain. You have different parts of the brain. They have different responses. They try to make sense of the experience. They try to make sense of how to handle what is necessarily perceived as a threat, because you know consciously, but also these other parts of your brain, of parts of your nervous system, also know that the end result of if you keep doing that is death. And that is a serious matter. So to find peace and relaxation with that kind of perspective, both conscious and unconscious, is where it's at. Because anyone can agitate. Anyone can be like, this is horrible. I hate it. Why am I doing that? And it sucks and it's painful, or it's whatever. Anyone can respond that way. Anyone can also try to use their willpower, the same kind of willpower that makes you run a bit faster, try to lift a little heavier, try to suck it up, whatever it is, when it's unpleasant. Keep going. You can try to use that kind of willpower. It will take you a bit further, but it's also a form of agitation. And agitation will defeat you ultimately. So yeah, you really have to enter relaxation. Yes, it's all predictable. In fact, you can predict the whole context where you hold your breath. Is it going to be in a certain location and a certain time, with light around you, no light, sounds around you, no sounds? Where you sit, or do you lay down, in what position, how long you're going to hold your breath for, do you hold your breath after an exhale, after a forced exhale, after a maximum inhale. And then once you get started, all you know is that it only gets worse. And to find amusement in that, or even excitement, or detachment. To find detachment is actually your best. You may have a moment of excitement because, let's say, you want to surpass yourself. But before you hold your breath, you will have to detach from everything. You'll have to detach from your worries, from your self-confidence. If you need confidence, but it can't be cocky. You need motivation, but it can't be like, let's do it. It's not that way. Everything has to be very, very calm, very, very calm. So it's really a school of learning who you are and how you choose to respond to what is inherently a challenging experience that can easily turn into complete negativity. And to achieve goodness at every level, a positive mind, clear, confident, trusting, patient, self-compassionate, equanimity, and consistency, all the way. That is where it's at. So it's really a practice of the mind. But who is the mind? We are the mind. So it's the mind practicing itself. That is the very foundation of meditation. The mind observing itself, but also the mind fashioning itself. And this is very important because in meditation, you will typically be told to let yourself think and just observe your thinking. Well, let me tell you that observing your thinking when you hold your breath, that's not going to cut it. Because by default, whoever you are, even if you're a monk in the Himalayas, you'll get very negative quickly. And you'll have all sorts of negative thoughts. So observing your negative thoughts is not going to help you. When you meditate, typically, you know that you will observe yourself thinking and probably thinking more than you would like to think. And thinking all of a sudden about things, we're like, why am I even thinking about that? What does that even matter? Or what's the meaning of this? So can you hold your breath just letting yourself randomly think about whatever? You could, but that's not going to help you establish what you need. We're talking about clarity. We're talking about centeredness, can you really afford the luxury of whatever random thoughts to happen? Or do you have to really master your inner experience? And that's the point. What I teach people is how they're going to master their inner experience. It should not be random thoughts about whatever. It should not be all negativity because, again, you don't need to learn that. It's by default our response, a universal response. What is challenging is to establish the opposite of that, which is goodness, the antidote. You are going to be impatient. Well, it is in your hands to establish patience. Where does that patience come? From the same place that impatience comes from. Then you set commitment, and then now you want to quit. Where does commitment come from? From the same place that lack thereof comes from. Etc., etc., etc. You're not trusting the experience. You feel threatened. That's why you want to quit. Well, you want to establish trust. Where does that trust come from? Same place your lack of trust comes from. Same place your feeling of being threatened comes from. From the exact same place, from the very core of who you are. And who you are is not the house you own or rent or the car or the job or the name or the clothes or friends and the whole whatever happened to you and what your body looks like now at your age, your gender, your whatever. That is not who you are. Who you are is who you choose to express and experience in this very moment. That is who you are in every moment. So what is being expressed? What do you choose to express? Because whatever you're going to express under that form of stress is going to be who you choose to be. And if you have a clarity and the consistency to express patience and trust and self-compassion and love while you are under a stress that you yourself created, it's very likely that you will be able to, that ability and those qualities will carry over other circumstances of life. When you do have an interaction with other people, with the world, because when you are holding your breath, you're in your bubble. There's no interaction with the world. You are the whole world, and the only interaction you have is with yourself. What is happening there? But not when you have a luxury of breathing, maybe floating and, you know, like relaxing, some gentle music, a bit of incense, a little candle is good. No. Now that's easy to, that's relatively easy, right? Not that easy, by the way. Even in that kind of context, some people are still bringing on all their stress, all their worries. What's going to happen? And that person's bothering me and this and that. And so imagine no incense, no music, no mala, no mantra, not even slow breathing. Just hold your breath, stress yourself out. And now you choose who you want to be through the kind of response that you create. You and nothing else. You're the world in this moment. Anything that happens, anything that is being experienced is on you.
That's beautifully said. And I guess through that practice, as you develop your relationship with yourself, it will translate to how you relate to all other things, whether it be loved ones, environment, whatever. I mean, you are altering the way that you show up in the world.
That won't make you perfect. That won't make you insensitive or all positive. But you will definitely, if you can achieve this kind of emotional stability and clarity.
Mental
clarity in that context, it's very likely that it will support also being having the ability to respond or to interact that way with others. Not a guarantee, obviously.
Right. But you're cultivating the quality. So the quality will get stronger. Like as you become more self-compassionate through that practice, as you practice, you become a more self-compassionate person.
Yes, and it starts obviously within.
Yeah. You have a beautiful way of explaining these things, and it's very inspiring. I feel like it's inspiring me. Like I'm looking forward to going to another level and deepening my own practice, and I would like to take one of your courses. So from what I understand, you offer online courses. Do they have like a live component to it, or?
I have one e-course. It's called the Breathful Work Meditation.
Okay.
Course. And so it's four modules, and you have like more than 100 videos. There's a lot of insights. I connect a lot of dots.
Okay. And where is that at breathholdwork.com?
Yes, it is. And then there is a live. I do the same. I cover the same content within 8 sessions in 1 week. 4 weeks, 1 month. it's a live version of it. The next starts early January.
Soon.
Okay. Eight groups. And, you know, on top of, you know, people report that their day-to-day breathing rate, you know, the speed at which they breathe is really, really reduced. So people learn to breathe much slower than before, take less breaths, which quiets the hearts, quiets the minds. And also they report a lot of just being much more calmer, much calmer in their life. And of course, there's also the aspect which is their ability to hold their breath a much, much longer time. So we're talking about people who can barely hold their breath for a minute and then end up being able to hold their breath for 4 minutes. We've had people who were able to hold their breath for five and for some 6 minutes. So everyone at least doubles, if not triples, quadruples. We have had cases of people multiplying their breath holding ability by five.
That's wild.
Huh. And that's without hyperventilation. Okay. So we're not going like, we're not doing this. It's just, and most importantly, because that's within 4 weeks, you are going to have some physiological adaptations within 4 weeks, but they cannot explain that somebody would triple, quadruple their breath all time. The reason and the explanation is because they learn tolerance. They learn to tolerate. And how do they learn to tolerate? They learn to tolerate by understanding what is exactly going on in their body, in their mind, in their heart. And many, many tools, many insights, many tools that I connect to just be completely present and at the same time detached from it all. That's the paradox. It's presence and detachment at the same time.
Nice. Tolerance is an important word. I feel like right now, if you peer through your screen, your device, and get a glimpse of what goes on in the world, there's room for a lot more tolerance in general.
It's the story of the world, I think, always will be.
It's an overlooked quality, and breath work is just one more tool, I guess, to practice that. My favorite thing about the tool of our breath is, you know, it's just with you all the time. It's portable, it's free, and everybody has access to it. There's no socioeconomic barrier. There's, you know, just a very low price of entry. And it still goes overlooked, underrated. Yeah, I mean, better than any tool you could find in the gym, whatever. It's like, it's the best, and we all have it. So I'm honored to be a conduit for your message, to hopefully inspire others to look inward, to dive a little deeper themselves and see what's there to offer themselves through that practice. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know we're a little bit past when you had to get out of here, so I want to get you out of here, but we will link to breathholdwork.com. I want to look in. Hopefully I will see you in that course in January, Erwan. That sounds fantastic. And for the listeners out there, I really appreciate you tuning in. I hope you got some value out of this conversation. And if you have any questions, send them my way. And if I can't answer it, we'll see if we can get Erwan to and follow up. Thanks, everybody. Have a terrific day.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to my conversation with Erwan LaCour. I hope that you found some inspiration from this. If you're not already used to looking at your outdoor space as an extension of your living space, then I encourage you to explore. What does your environment have to offer you when you change the lens that you see it through? Also, if you're not used to doing breath hold work, I encourage you to dip your toe in it and see what there is to experience. Both of these modalities, whether it's integrating the outdoors with your movement and exercise and fitness practices, or going deeper in the way you manipulate your breath and alter your relationship with your autonomic nervous system, whatever it is, there are upgrades in your sense of well-being through those practices. So I encourage you to explore, and I hope this conversation can be the spark you need to take a next step. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope everybody has a terrific day.